If you come to Street and you buy a cup of coffee, you know, you're not just getting caffeine, you're creating a cup of belonging for a young person who you know, has come from a situation you wouldn't have ever imagined. So for me, if I'm most proud of one thing in this last decade, we've used caffeine as the gateway drug to belonging.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. With the uncertainty of how our society will emerge from the impact of the pandemic, one thing that has been apparent is the rise of homelessness. Probably the least talked about in that is youth homelessness. In a world where many of us are wondering what the immediate future may hold, what impact is that having on disillusioned and disadvantaged youth with no support network? Rebecca Scott is the co-founder and CEO of Street Cafe. Rebecca, how are you going?
I'm great, thank you.
We've got lots to talk about. You created Street with some other people quite some time ago, where you offer disadvantaged youth a supported pathway. Can you start by telling us about Street?
Sure. As it turns out, we were supposed to have our 10th birthday the first weekend of the Melbourne lockdown. So we still haven't, we've turned 10, but we haven't actually celebrated our 10th birthday. So yeah, we've been going for a decade now. And really we started Street originally out of frustration, just that thought that, you know, a kid in Australia who was coming from, you know, a family of maybe abuse or poverty or maybe, you know, drug and alcohol addiction. There's a whole bunch of reasons that kids become homeless. That, you know, where your starting point in this country can also obviously kind of influence the rest of your life. And it just didn't feel like in a land of opportunity and wealth like ours that shouldn't be the case, that we should have the ability to, no matter where a kid starts, to be able to catch them up and take them from, you know, take them into to thriving and into kind of realizing their dreams. So, but what we realized, I guess, is, you know, when we stood back and looked at the issue of homelessness, homelessness was often being, you know, looked at as a housing issue rather than a more holistic issue, and rather than seeing kind of actually there's a whole bunch of issues that have created a young person's homelessness. Actually, we've got to work not only in a preventative way, but in a really early intervention way and address all of those things that have led to the homelessness, not just the housing at the, you know, which is the symptom at the end. So how do we create the right kind of constellation of supports for a young person? And obviously, critical part of that is, you know, employment pathways. If you're a kid and if you're homeless, you can't afford your rent in a house if you can't get a job. You can't get a job if you can't get training. You can't get training if you've got too many issues going on for you. So, of course, we needed to not only kind of get you your skilling, but we needed to remove a bunch of the other barriers that were there in the first place.
Well, there's quite a few people involved in the beginning of Street. How did you pull those people together and how did you get it all started?
Oh, look, it sounds kind of harebrained when I think about it now, because I was at the CSIRO working in science, so I had no background whatsoever in either homelessness, youth, hospitality or social enterprise. So I couldn't have been coming in kind of greener, you know, to the problem. And my co-founder and partner and wife, Kate, she's Street's clinical psychologist and chief impact officer. Kate had, you know, decades of work also working as a clinical psych, but similarly she hadn't been in social enterprise or specifically in hospitality. So both of us kind of embarked upon this journey together, and I'm kind of glad in one sense we didn't know what we were kind of embarking upon, because we probably wouldn't have started the journey if we'd known all the things that we didn't know. But I think it was really it was that driving sense that, you know, hey, this is a complex problem and we need to think about an holistic solution to a complex problem. And really where we were, you know, we were living in Canberra at the time, and we realised that probably Canberra wasn't big enough to build the kind of organisation that we thought was needed. So we were umming and ahhing, you know, do we go to Sydney? And in actual fact, Sydney was going to be our first place to go and build street, because I'm from New South Wales originally and Kate's from Sydney. And so we thought, you know, go back home to where our families were. And then actually we realized that that Melbourne was very much the beating heart and the capital city for social enterprise in Australia. Go where there's more people doing this stuff so you can learn from them. So really, you know, it feels like street has been this enormous group hug from all of these social entrepreneurs and social innovators who really wrapped their arms around us when we arrived as, you know, two young women with a tiny little baby, you know, with all of our life packed into a back of a shitty old Corolla, going, right, we're here, we're going to start building this thing. And oh my God, I mean, what a, you know, with you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed in a big city. And then we've just sprinted like hell for the last decade to try and build. But, you know, just to give you a sense of where we're up to now, you know, we've built 11, you know, hospitality social enterprises. We've worked really intensively with over 500 kids and another 1,500 kids in our outreach program. So, you know, we've learned some stuff. We've failed at a bunch of stuff as well, but we've also got some really, you know, we've learned some really exciting stuff along that decade.
You found a problem and you went out to sort of solve it in a way, or alleviate, or at least shine a light on it as well. What is the problem that you see with homelessness in Australia? What sort of numbers are we talking about, and what's the impact?
Look, certainly across Australia, we've got, you know, more than 112,000 now, I think the number is. Oh, that was pre-COVID as well. 112,000 homeless in Australia. So just to give you a sense, that's, you know, that's more than the MCG full of people. So it's a lot of people. Part of the challenge is that when we think about homelessness as a community, you know, most of us probably, you know, if we say that word, probably what pops into our mind is a dishevelled older man who's got an alcoholic problem, sleeping rough in a park. They're often the kind of images that come into our mind, whereas actually the majority of people, you know, that are homeless in Australia are children and mothers. So we've got a really disproportionate number of you know, mothers, for example, fleeing domestic violence with their children. There's a lot of, you know, the majority of homelessness is invisible to us. It's the, you know, it's the mums and kids, you know, that are sleeping in their van. It's the people couch surfing. It's all of that stuff that we don't see. So we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg, because we're only seeing rough sleepers. We're not seeing actually the enormous iceberg that's sitting beneath that, that's often invisible to us. And sadly also, you know, where the real growth in homelessness numbers has been, you know, most recently across the last number of years is older women. So we're rapidly seeing the rise of, you know, older women who, you know, may have, you know, been divorced from their husbands or fleeing domestic violence, don't, because they have often been doing, you know, mothering duties and haven't been in the workforce getting superannuation, you know, they will have lost a lot of, they won't have the same, you know, superannuation, you know, that their husbands may have had. So they're a really vulnerable group. So within, I guess what I'm saying is, within that kind of cohort of homelessness, when you start to break it down, there's a whole heap of sub cohorts in there, and women and children, you know, are right at the top of that list.
You mentioned that you've created 11 hospitality businesses in the last decade. Can you give us an idea of how they work and what opportunities are given to those in need?
Yeah, look, originally we started out just with a couple of food carts, and we evolved very quickly, I guess, to move into cafes. And so now we have a whole heap of mainly all inner city cafes. And we've got a bigger footprint than people would probably know, because some of our cafes aren't visible. So, for example, we run the ANZ Cafe, we run the AMP Cafe. So we're often embedded inside other corporates where we'll be running their cafe, but you know, you won't see our name on the ground floor when you walk in, but we're the ones that are the, you know, inside those organizations. The way it works, and then we've got a catering company, a coffee roastery, and an artisan bakery as well. The way it works for a young person, so if I think about it from their perspective, you normally come to Street for kind of internally at Street for 6 months, and then you're with our partner organizations for an additional 6 months. So for your first 6 months, you know, the way you would come to Street in the first place is you're normally going to be referred by an agency that you'll, you know, that you'll will have turned to for help. Now that might be a mental health organization, it might be a homelessness service, it might be a prison, might be a ethnic and multicultural organization. So young people are normally sent to us by agencies, and normally because those agencies might have helped with a little bit of the problem, but they can't, you know, they can't do the training and employment pathway stuff themselves. When you arrive with us, what we do is we do a so in addition to, you know, that team of amazing, you know, obviously I've got lots of, you know, chefs and baristas and bakers and all of those hospo types of people, but embedded in that team are also psychologists and youth workers and social workers and our beautiful therapy dog Magic. So when you arrive at Street as a young person, what we're doing is that youth team with all of those kind of allied health professionals, they're doing an assessment of, right, you know, where are you coming from? What are the major issues we've got to work with? Where, you know, what are your dreams for the future? Where do you want to be? And what do we, you know, what do we need to sort out for you to reach those dreams? And then, so if a young person, you know, if a young person X comes in and needs specific help around, you know, the constellation of their issues might be, you know, drug and alcohol and mental health and homelessness, well then, you know, we're linking them in. If they don't already have those services attached to them, we're linking them into those specialist services. You know, for another young person, it might be they're in prison and they're coming to us on day release, and so we're working a lot within, you know, juvenile justice and their prison workers. So each young person, they get a very, even though they come in as a group, so they might come in as a group of, you know, 12 to 16 kids at a time. So they come in as a class, but we're working, you know, very individually with them on the specific things that we need to kind of help them with. So they've got a kind of personal plan for that 6 months. And so the way it works across a week, you know, say like on a Monday, you might be working with the, you know, the well, health and wellbeing team, you know, to on those personal issues that are there. One day a week, you might be, you're at TAFE getting your qualifications. So you're getting hospitality qualifications, certificate two. And then the other days a week, you're at work. So you might be working in our cafe, you might be working in our catering company, and it's all real work, you know. It's, but the things that you're learning at TAFE that week, you will now be putting into practice in the businesses. And what we would do is every 5 weeks, we would rotate you to another business, so you get a different bunch of skills. So if you're in a cafe, obviously in a cafe you're going to get customer service sort of skills, whereas if you're in a production kitchen, you're not going to be customer facing, you're going to get a different set of skills. So what we want is we're really giving you a whole range of general skills. So across that 6 months, you really get a sense of what you're great at, what you love, you know, where you might want to go next, what kind of environment. And we don't care less whether or not you want to be in hospo, you know, longer term. We just know hospitality is a really good stepping stone job, that it, you know, the kind of skills that you get in hospitality are really transferable into other industries. So if we know, hey, you want to be, you know, you want to be in retail, well, actually we can give you a load of customer service experience, and we build your journey to make sure that then your journey goes in the direction that you want it to go in. But to be honest, most kids, when they come to us, they probably have less idea about where they want to be longer term. They just don't, you know, often it's survival. They just need to be able to put, they need to be able to, you know, get a wage so they can eat, or get a wage so they can get their kids back, you know, out of foster care, or stay clean, you know, stay off drugs and be supporting themselves. So often at those early, you know, in those early to be honest, probably the first 3 or 4 years for a kid once they come to us, it's really about just survival. Whereas, you know, the lovely thing is a decade on now, you can see, you know, those 500 graduates, they've gone into all different directions. At the moment, we've got kids studying PhDs in English literature at uni. We've got kids that are youth workers, kids that are childcare workers, but they all started off in hospo.
You mentioned there's around 112,000 homeless in Australia at the moment that we know of, and there's also a rise in older women homelessness as well. How have you seen the last 6 or 7 months, given the impact of the pandemic has been so swift and brutal to so many?
Look, I think it's been a very, very mixed time. So if I think about it personally from Street's perspective, one of the absolutely distressing things was that obviously, you know, running hospitality social enterprises, we had to close the doors of all of our cafes, you know, 6 months ago. So what that meant is all of that training, you know, training that young people was doing, we had to close all of our programs. We couldn't have all those young people coming into Street because our businesses were all closed. So many of the community service organizations who would have, you know, would have had their clients and their, you know, cohorts kind of coming into their agencies were now all being, you know, having to pivot and do all of that by phone or do that by, you know, video conference. And so the way we deliver our services has been highly disrupted through this time. What it's also meant is that often as you would probably understand, you know, young people might be coming to us often, for example, because they come from families where there's a lot of family violence. Now, if you're in lockdown and you're in that family and you're now, you know, you now have nowhere to go, you know, to kind of escape that. We know, and we've also been seeing that in the statistics kind of nationally, that the family violence hotlines have absolutely been overwhelmed with calls from families that are really doing it tough. So what we know is for many of the young people that were at Street who might have been very precariously at home, and they were, you know, they were escaping family violence. They're back in those families that are really often very, very toxic for them. But on the flip side, you know, what you probably would have seen in Melbourne is the city made a real commitment that all of those rough sleepers would be housed in hotels. So it's been about the first time, well, I think the first time probably ever that, you know, in the decade that I've been living in Melbourne, it's the first time ever that you would have been walking down any of our streets and you wouldn't have seen rough sleepers. So what we've seen is parts of the homelessness system, you know, those rough sleepers will have been more cared for and have more stable accommodation and be safer than they will have ever been probably in their lives through this pandemic. But then those others who may have been in, you know, rooming houses or boarding houses and that kind of highly unsafe sort of, you know, housing situation are going to be way worse because they're locked down in with their perpetrators. They're locked down in those unsafe environments. So I don't think there's not a one size fits all answer to that. It's highly dependent on kind of where you're sitting in the system. But the one thing that we do know is that there's more pressure on the system. So we know the second that you start to send large, large numbers of people into unemployment, of course your homelessness numbers are going to go up. Is if you've got, you know, large numbers of families defaulting on their mortgages and now, you know, don't or can't pay their rent, of course, you know, the homelessness system, you know, and public housing is what gets put under strain. And I know, you know, from probably listening to the same media reports as you've been, you know, we're hearing all of the state governments really talking about the strain that's being put on, you know, public housing because there's just not enough beds there to be able to service all of those people that are now under mortgage stress or have already lost their houses because they can't pay their rent because they've lost their job. So I think, you know, I think we're in for, you know, decades potentially of of, you know, incredible pressure placed on our homelessness services, and you would fully expect that we will see a big spike in homelessness numbers, the same as we normally would if there's a recession.
You mentioned a bit earlier, and everyone in this series has talked about the impact of the pandemic on the hospitality sector, and the core of your business is to help those that are in need, but it's also a hospitality business. What's been the impact on the venues that you have given the lockdown?
Look, most of our venues closed within weeks. So, you know, particularly if I'm thinking about those corporate cafes that we ran, you know, all those corporates closed their doors and all their staff started working from home. So, you know, most of our businesses closed very, very early. We've got a couple of businesses. Of our 11 businesses, only three are operational. So it's very, very light on. We've had loads of people sitting on JobKeeper and kind of surviving like, you know, any of those hospitality organisations is at the moment with their doors closed. Having said that, you know, the silver lining, I guess, so if I talk about kind of business as usual is in tatters around our, you know, around my ankles. But having said that, one of the really joyous things to come out of this pandemic has been the work that we've been doing with our social enterprise peers in the food relief kind of area. And I think what, you know, as the pandemic really started to hit, you know, it was kind of obvious that the food relief system was going to have all this extra strain put on it. And the food relief agencies were really going to be struggling because, you know, if you look at any of those agencies, most of them rely heavily on volunteers. Often those volunteers are retirees. And if all of a sudden we've got people who can't volunteer and often an older cohort that, you know, that is at home isolating, you know, because they're older and more compromised, immune compromised potentially. What it also meant is that a lot of the services couldn't be delivered the same way. So often food relief, you know, will, you know, it might be a homelessness agency or a community organization that would have the Fair Share van rock up and provide them with thousands and thousands of meals. And those meals would all be delivered by the community organization to, you know, to their clients. Well, if all the clients aren't coming into those community organizations and now you've got people kind of stuck at home but are food insecure, how do you get all those meals out to those people with a totally different distribution model? So what we've really done, I guess, is started hustling a whole heap of, you know, other social enterprises, you know, food social enterprises like ourselves, to start to collaborate together. So, you know, we've collectively now made over 120,000 ready-made meals that have gone to particularly multicultural communities. We've made something like 20,000 fresh produce boxes that have gone out to different communities. So we've been really busy, but just busy, you know, providing food to a totally different cohort than we would normally work with. So I've still got, you know, my kitchens are still open and we're still churning out amazing meals, but none of those meals are being sold. Those meals are normally being funded through philanthropy that is then going out to, you know, high needs groups that need it. So we haven't been twiddling our thumbs or, you know, spending the pandemic watching Netflix. We've been busy, but a very different type of busy. But I think one of the lovely things is that, you know, because we're all food social enterprises who, you know, our DNA is using food to do good and create kind of social change. We're just doing that in a really different way. So even though our young people aren't in training, we're still very much creating social impact.
Hospitality venues are renowned for low margins, and at a time like this, what you do is more vital than ever for people in need. How are you feeling about the future of the model that you have that's part hospitality and part helping people that need it most in society?
Look, that's a really good question because I think often people don't realise how low margin hospitality is. They might see a busy cafe and go, oh my God, you know, those guys must be raking in money. And so it, you know, even a traditional cafe is going to be operating on a wafer thin margin. Now, that's before you add psychologists and youth workers and social workers and absolutely unemployed staff, unemployable staff into the mix. So if you think about my business model, and it sounds ridiculous when I say it out loud, but my business model really says, I go out and say, so I'm going to put my job ad out for my hospitality, you know, hospitality employees. And the business model said, my job ad would say, if you're a homeless young person, you've got a drug and alcohol addiction issue, you've just come from prison, you've got severe mental health issues, and you are absolutely unemployable, you are our perfect employee. And then what we do is embed you in the heart of our business. So, you know, obviously, if that's your business model, that you're going to take unemployable people and put them in the heart of your business, it's going to be more expensive. Not only are you going to have people that are more, you know, that aren't skilled and need, you know, that are more unproductive, so I've got way lower levels of productivity, but I also need a way higher number of highly skilled staff and trainers and all of that support function in over and above that. So when we talk about hospo, you know, say it's a 5% you know, profit margin industry, I know that I bring 20% of extra operating overhead to do the social stuff in our business. So you have a model, you know, you essentially have a recipe for going very, very bankrupt when you're in a small margin industry and you're trying to load on all of this extra social impact that you're doing. So the only way that our model stacks up and the reason why we've got 11 businesses is because what we've done is we've built a portfolio of businesses. And we couldn't survive if we only did cafes. You know, cafes are too small margin to be able to be only a cafe social enterprise model. There's a reason why we've got catering in there. Catering is way better margins than cafes. So what we've got, I guess, in the totality of our business model or of our portfolio, I guess, in pre-pandemic, we were 90% self-funded through our portfolio. So what that means is, you know, we were hardly grant reliant. We were getting to a point where we were, you know, really standing on our own feet and doing, you know, the business profits were funding all of that extra kind of social stuff that we were doing. But I think it gets that much more complicated, you know, post pandemic, post pandemic, you know, hospo is going to be really not working kind of well at all. And I think we're going to probably look like a pretty different organization at the other end. I think I would be surprised if some of our businesses, you know, didn't make it all the way through. Having said that, I think we're going to end up looking quite different, and I think we'll kind of go sideways also into urban agriculture. So I think we'll go probably more into food production and food growing and create new training and employment pathways for young people into urban agriculture. So we become the farmers as well as the, you know, the food growers. And I think so we're just starting that work now. We've got a new market garden that we're establishing across at Collingwood Children's Farm. We've got our first horticulturalists that are working across there, getting ready now for our first young people to come into training in horticulture. So I think, you know, coming into this new year, we'll be not just a hospitality organisation, but also a horticulture organisation, and going to start to be probably, we're going to look quite different. And I think we'll probably end up with what will over time be almost like a distributed urban farm, where we might have whereas we might have been running the cafe at ANZ, you know, we might in the future also be running an olive orchard on top of their rooftop at the same time, as well as their cafe. So we end up with this really building actually food system. So rather than just being, you know, in food service, food service organisation, we're actually a food system organisation.
Melbourne had the second lockdown and the numbers are getting lower and lower, and it looks like heading closer towards opening up society again. What's it feel like being in Melbourne at the moment? How have you been in this period?
Oh, look, it would be fair to say that we're all going a bit stir crazy. from a personal perspective, I've been doing an enormous amount of kind of backyard growing, you know, with my partner Kate and our son Will. So our backyard garden, you know, is looking incredibly healthy. So we've been growing, doing our own urban farming activity. So we're growing about a third of our food at the moment in the backyard in a tiny, tiny little inner city, you know, house. So we haven't got a big farming kind of spot at all. It's a tiny backyard, but so we've been doing loads of kind of staying sane through our own gardening activity. But there's such a sense of excitement. So even though our businesses are, it's going to be a long, long road out, you know, it's going to be very slow for us to kind of claw our way back out of the pandemic from a business sense. I feel like that combination between, you know, it's starting to get warm. Our biggest site, our big production site is a site in Collingwood, and it's just beautiful, and it's got these beautiful garden. And so the team over there have been getting so excited about, you know, when you come to, as a customer to Street, hopefully only a couple of weeks away when we're out of lockdown, you know, you'll be able to come out and you'll be sitting in our garden to have your meal. And yes, there'll be far less people there because it's all socially distanced, of course. But I think we're getting very creative about how to use the space. The other thing we've been doing is playing a lot, and we've been developing a lot of different types of food products. So we've just at the moment just launching our new picnic hamper range. So essentially you would come to Street, you would come through and you would, you know, you would walk through, you would have pre-ordered your picnic hamper. And then what we're giving you is everything you need to go and have a beautiful meal in the park with, you know, with family and friends. So you're eating our food, but it's not in our locations because we're really limited in the number of people we'll be able to seat. So some of that stuff we've been developing throughout the pandemic. And so we've done a lot of home delivery, huge numbers of meals we've been delivering to customers at home, doing a lot of the other thing we've been doing, a lot of the corporates that we, you know, that we're normally working with and delivering, you know, delivering kind of coffee to every day, because they've got so many staff that are working from home now, what they've been doing is sending beautiful care packages and food hampers to their teams that we've been making. So they might say, hey, can we have 1,000 or 500 gift hampers of beautiful, delicious food from you for all of our teams? And we'll then have that delivered to a home. So it might have beautiful, freshly roasted coffee from our roastery, beautiful fresh loaves of artisan bread, some beautiful marmalade that we may have made. So it'll be like a beautiful group hug from your workplace and all of that delicious food, but it's now as, you know, a care package for home. So we are incredibly grateful for those corporates that have, you know, continue to contract our goods and services, but in a very different way than we normally would. So if I think about how many kilometres we will have racked up, you know, our van drivers delivering all of those care packages all around, you know, Melbourne, and some of those actually have been going interstate. So we're at the moment, we're making a whole heap of care packages for Westpac staff all around the country. So they're sending out care packages to masses of staff, and they've ordered. So Sydney has ordered masses amounts of our food that longer shelf life product. So it might be jams or chutneys or preserves or coffee, things that have a long shelf life, all to put in their care packages for their teams. And so our kitchens have been absolutely flat out making all that longer shelf life product that all then get shipped to Sydney that they then make into masses of hampers that go out across the country. So certainly, you know, once again, we've kind of needed to really, really show, you know, and that's been us actively kind of going out to those corporates saying, hey, by the way, we've got some other products and services on offer here, and them going, fantastic. Yes, we'll have 500 of them. Thanks. So, yeah, it's, you know, our kitchens are being flat out, but geez, it's been, you know, very different kind of to, you know, normally we've got, you know, on any given week, we'd be creating so many a la carte meals and you'd be coming in and you'd be sitting in a, you know, in a beautiful cafe or restaurant. There's been none of that, but loads of amazing food going out, you know, home delivery or hampers. Or obviously those ready-made meals, all those, you know, ready-made meals for the food relief system.
You've had a lot of graduates from your program. Is there one or two graduate stories that stand out to you?
Oh, it's like asking me who's my favorite children. There are so many unbelievable stories. And I, the amazing thing that happened, and it was one of the most precious things that has happened to me in this last decade. So I, at the beginning of the interview, I talked about the fact that we were supposed to have our 10th birthday the first weekend of lockdown, so we never actually got to have our birthday. The thing that did happen, which was just unbelievable, about 3 weeks before the pandemic happened, for the first time, we brought all of the young people across all the years back together for a celebration.
Wow.
And so there were kids that I hadn't seen for 9 years. Oh my God. God, it was just, the second the first kid walked in the door, shouldn't call them kids because they're very much, you know, amazing young men and women and young trans people. And when those first young men and women walked in the door, I just burst into tears because there were kids, you know, there were young people there that, you know, I was so relieved that they was still alive. You know, they come to us in such a terrible, terrible state that, you know, you lie awake in the middle of the night and think, I wonder what happened to that kid. God, I hope, you know, they manage, you know, they might have come to us with years, for example, with a drug, you know, drug addiction. You know, they managed to stay clean in the time that they were with us. You know that they were in a job, you know, you had a year of contact with them following the program. They might have dropped in and out, you know, they might have dropped in kind of every couple of years and said hi. But there were so many kids that just, you know, moved into state that we didn't hear from. And so what we did is for months try and track down as many of those 500 young people as we could find and then invite them back. And it was just so incredible to see them after all of this time. And naturally, you know, many of them are now parents. Some of the things that were really quite extraordinary, many of those young people would have been because they came from kind of families of poverty and violence and often kind of very intergenerational issues. Many of the young people who come to street would have been taken off their families when they were very young themselves. So really, you know, they started life behind the eight ball as, you know, as little babies, and they would have spent a lot of time in the foster care system themselves. But they will now have children. This is the first generation that haven't been taken off their families. So this is the first generation where the poverty stops. And that has been unbelievable. I think about one young woman who came. I know she was the fourth generation of family members. She was the first young person in that family to have a job in four generations. She was a graduate in our very first class. She went on to do her full apprenticeship in, and she's been working as a chef for the last eight years, been working as a chef. She's traveled the world as a chef, working overseas, was working in London, you know, traveled all around the place. But you take those kind of stories where for us it might not seem that remarkable that a young person's got a job and they, you know, they've got a chef apprenticeship. But if you know the backstory of that young person and know this is the first young person in four generations that's had a job, and the first, you know, the first kids that have now kept their own children, you know, they haven't had their own children taken off them by DHHS and they've got stable homes and they've got, you know, they're not in homelessness services themselves. I think about the young trans person who came out at street had the bravery to come out as a trans person at street, had been in the closet before that, but now studying, you know, a PhD in English literature at Monash University. You know, a young person who'd been sleeping rough, and I remember one of the first conversations that I had with them was them describing the best way to break into a dumpster and how you dumpster dive and the way you pick the lock, the way you, because all those locks, you know, the big food premises normally have, you know, bins that are all locked at night. But they told me, you know, how you undo the lock and how you pick the lock. And they drew me a picture of how you pick the lock of a great big dumpster to be able to get in and get your food at night. They drew me this cartoon. But, you know, this is a young person who has now been partnered for years, left street to become a Ausland interpreter because really wanted to work very much kind of, you know, supporting communities where they were seeing there were some real issues, and then ended up, you know, saying, actually, I wanted to do a PhD in English literature, going off to uni, and just to see them happy and healthy and proud of themselves and their gender identity stuff that was also complex and raw back then in the coming out process was also new, you know, feeling proud of themselves, stable and in a loving environment, you know, loving partnership, and had been for years. And when I still remember that night, you know, saying, what is it, you know, why did street matter to you? And they said, street was the first place that I saw loving relationships. And I thought for the first time as a young queer that I could have a loving relationship and someone might love me one day too. And so, you know, for them, the biggest thing to come out of street was actually getting a sense of this is what healthy relationships look like. You know, it wasn't, you know, yes, we helped them with their housing stability, but for them it was being able to model what a future might look like for them. For other young people, when I said to them, why did street matter to them? Once again, the answer wasn't normally you sorted me with a house. It was things like, this was the first place where I felt like I could be me, or this was the first place I felt included and I belonged. And so what came out again and again and again throughout that night was the thing that was most precious to those young people was a sense of connectedness and belonging. And that was often for them, you know, that was a bigger hole in their lives than actually all of the other stuff that had been, you know, that was in the way and the barriers that are there. It was that sense of I belong in my community and I matter. And that's pretty precious thing, you know. That makes for a pretty special cup of coffee. If you come to street and you buy a cup of coffee, you know, you're not just getting an amazing, you know, you're not just getting caffeine. You're creating a cup of belonging for a young person who, you know, has come from a situation you wouldn't have ever imagined. So for me, if I'm most proud of one thing in this last decade, we've used caffeine as the gateway drug to belonging.
Well, Rebecca, what you and Kate have created is absolutely extraordinary, and we're honoured to have you on Deep in the Weeds. Please keep in touch, and we'll talk again soon.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you so much for the conversation. Really, yeah, absolute pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's HOSPO community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.